From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're watching reaction to President Trump's decision to revoke the security clearance of former CIA Director John Brennan. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Trump cited Brennan's involvement in what he called the rigged witch hunt into Russian interference as a reason for his decision. Brennan was one of those who presented evidence to Mr. Trump shortly before the inauguration that Russia had interfered in the election. Well, today, Brennan fired back in an op-ed in the New York Times website, saying Trump's claims of no collusion with Russia in the 2016 elections are hogwash. So we're going to follow that fight, but the jury is deliberating today in the first trial to come from the Russia investigation, though it's not directly tied to it. Former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort is charged with fraud and tax evasion. Yesterday, we saw closing arguments. The defense chose not to call any witnesses, and Paul Manafort himself never spoke except to say that he would not speak. NPR justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been following all of this. Hi, Ryan.
Hello there.
And let's consider what the jury is considering. The prosecution called 27 witnesses. None drew more attention than Rick Gates, Manafort's former business partner. He had damning testimony about Manafort, you know, hiding his funds and doing exactly what he's been charged with, fraud, tax evasion. The defense in its closing arguments tried to diminish Gates' credibility. What'd they say?
Well, they basically said what they signaled they were going to do throughout the trial from opening statements, which is that Gates is not a reliable witness. He's not someone whose word you can take for granted. He's somebody who embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars from Manafort himself. One thing that they drew out over the course of Gates' testimony and cross-examination was that Gates had had an extramarital affair, which is something that they said pointed to his character. At the same point in time, though, you know, Gates had plenty to say that was damaging against Manafort. Testified in detail about this long-running scheme that Manafort had to evade U.S. taxes. Talked about how he and Manafort set up secret bank accounts in Cyprus to do so. And he talked about how Manafort had personally directed him to falsify financial statements for banks to get bank loans. And he said that everything was done at Manafort's direction. But again, this all comes back to the question, as the defense framed it, of can you actually trust what Rick Gates was telling you?
Yeah. And how did the prosecution in their closing arguments, you know, maybe try to shore him up?
Well, in their closing arguments, government attorney Greg Andres called the documents the star witness of this case. Not Rick Gates, but the documents. And the government presented a very long paper trail in this, nearly 400 exhibits in all. There were bank statements, emails, tax returns. And some of the emails had Manafort talking in his own terms about bank accounts and calling them my accounts. So there were a lot of exhibits, a lot of paper. And in fact, the jury is deliberating in what's normally their break room because it needs extra space to fit in all of the evidence into the room so that they can pour through it all. Now, Andres, in his closing argument, urged the jury to look at what witnesses said and see how it lines up with the documents and other testimony. And he said to do this in particular with Gates's testimony. He said that it will all corroborate itself. The evidence is overwhelming, he said, and there's only one possible verdict. And the government, of course, says that that verdict is guilty as charged.
Well, do you or maybe do legal scholars that you've been rubbing shoulders with as you attend this trial, do they have a sense of how long the jury might take?
Well, it's really impossible to say. The jury can take as much time or as little time as it wants to come to its decision. They didn't retire until after 9:30. This morning, they have to wait for the evidence to be brought into the room. They have to choose a foreperson, and then they have to go through what in total is 18 counts. So there's a lot of material to go through, a lot of decisions to be made. It's really impossible to say how long they will take. All that we can do right now is sit here and wait until they call us back to say that they have made a decision.
Well, and just briefly, we've spoken about the judge in this case who stirred a lot of controversy because of his comments throughout the trial. He had to apologize to the jury and ask them to disregard some of his comments about the prosecutors. You told me we'll see if he's as even-handed with the defense. Of course, we never got to see that because the defense put no witnesses. But what was the sense at the end of the day about how the judge's behavior might influence the jury when he really only had a chance to be tough on prosecution?
Well, it's hard to say. But as part of the formal instructions for the jury before they go retire to deliberate, the judge read as part of that the jury should not read into comments or questions that he made during the trial. He said the court doesn't have an an opinion on this. What he said shouldn't be viewed as an opinion on the verdict. Basically said, disregard what I said. Look at the evidence yourselves and make the decision that you feel is right.
How do I unhear what I heard? Ryan Lucas, NPR Justice Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
To Afghanistan now. ISIS is claiming responsibility for a suicide bombing that killed more than 30 students who were preparing for college. The BBC's Aliyah Atrafi is in Kabul. Tell us about the attack that happened yesterday. What exactly did happen?
A class packed with the students, all the age before 20, they were preparing for the university entry. So they were studying there, thinking they were safe because, you know, they're students, they're not soldiers. And then a suicide bomber goes inside, blows himself up, kills 48 people and injures a lot more. It took surprisingly a long time for the so-called Islamic State to claim responsibility, almost 24 hours, although the Taliban were very quick to say that it wasn't them. So today we had another small attack in Kabul, and that took the focus a little bit away. But then after that, when the IS claimed responsibility, it made it all very, very fresh again. And the emotions are pretty much boiling in the city. It's a city, you know, weeping, really.
To the extent that when ISIS claims responsibility for something like this attack on students yesterday, to the extent that that claim is credible, why would ISIS want to target young people, students?
ISIS is working on their brand. The brand is dependent on fear. Any headline is good headline. That's definitely the case for ISIS in Afghanistan. The Taliban are being very, very careful nowadays. They are keeping away from these ethnic, anything to do with the ethnic divisions or language related issues. But ISIS has a sort of, you know, in a sick way to say it, ISIS has found a market, and that's targeting the Shia group, the ethnic minorities in Afghanistan, because that's what ISIS did in Iraq. And so they're strengthening and maintaining that link, that look, you know, I'm not this lonely guy on the block that just appear. I am part of this global ideology, you know, ISIS in Iraq and ISIS in Afghanistan. And they call themselves actually ISIS in Khorasan, that, you know, it's an historical area of the region, which involves part of Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran.
Explain that a little bit more, if you can, Aliyah. When there's an attack on students, how does ISIS see that as almost a marketing tool?
ISIS is in a situation that they need attention and that they need headline. They feel threatened. They are being targeted by the American forces here, by the Afghan forces, and by the Taliban. So they are in a vulnerable state, but they feel the need to show that they are strong. So every now and then, they feel they have to do something. Doesn't matter whatever that is and how wrong that is.
So ISIS seems to be going after the softer targets. On the other hand, the Taliban seems to be going after security forces and the tougher targets. What can you tell us? I mean, there was the attack that, tell us if it's the Taliban or not, the attack that you said on the Afghan intelligence service today. What's the difference in the approach of the two, and does it have to do with the presumed power of them both?
On Taliban standards, today's attack was an opportunistic and small attack. Probably that's the reason why the Taliban so far haven't claimed responsibility. But any attacks that the Taliban are carrying out, and they have to be big attacks like the assault on Ghazni, they entered the city last Friday. These are before Eid. So during the Eid time, which is the coming Tuesday, we're expecting a ceasefire again. So before the ceasefire, Taliban felt they have to do something big so that during the ceasefire they don't come across as weak, and so they're talking from a position of strength and superiority, even if you speak with them.
Aliyah, there have been 5 American combat deaths in Afghanistan this year, the most recent one just on Sunday with a member of the Special Forces. Are American troops involved in these battles that you're talking about, either the battles that are perpetrated by ISIS or by the Taliban?
They are supposed to be predominantly in an advisory position here. But with the arrival of Trump administration, especially a lot of aerial attacks, drone attacks, this is where the Americans come into play. And they have been very, very helpful to the Afghan regime. So I think we expect them to be more involved in a way, even though this will be resisted from the American side, because as the situation deteriorates, then that pulls the Americans in more into the warfare.
All right. Thank you very much. The BBC's Alia Atrafi in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
Spike Lee's Black Klansman was one of his most successful film openings ever last weekend. It's based on the 2014 memoir from Ron Stallworth, the very real first black cop hired by the Colorado Springs Police Department in the 1970s, who went on to infiltrate and bring down a local chapter of the KKK. The film is hilarious. It is heartbreaking. It is based on a true story. But how much of it is true? We want to take a look. So, warning, warning, spoiler alert, there will definitely be some plot giveaways here, although not the very ending. But if you've seen the movie, we're going to answer some questions raised. And even if you haven't, you may be the kind of person like me heading into the theater this weekend, and we highly recommend you do, who wants to know, wait, is that true? So here we go with Jasmine Sanders of Slate. Jasmine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there's a card right at the beginning that flashes up. This movie is based on some faux real stuff. And it is. You could not make most of this up. The black cop of Ron Stallworth really did see an ad in the paper as he was sitting with the white cops at the station house. It was an ad for the Klan, and he called the number.
Yes. So Ron Stallworth was somewhat of a rookie cop still at that time. He'd been on in the force about 4 years when he decided that his next operation was going to be to infiltrate the Klan, which had somewhat of a burgeoning presence in Colorado at that time. So he sees a newspaper ad and kind of on a lark without his sergeant's permission or with any idea of what he was going to say or a script or forethought, called into the number, which is how he wound up speaking to an actual Klan representative and absentmindedly giving his own name and information.
Oops, that's a problem, and it becomes dangerous. But he's also black, so Ron Stallworth, played by John David Washington, Denzel Washington's son.
Yes.
He decides to do the phone work with the Klan and ask a white cop, played by Adam Driver, to be him in meetings with the Klan. Driver's white cop is not happy, and Stallworth asks him why.
This is the job. What's your problem?
That's my problem. For you, it's a crusade. For me, it's a job. It's not personal, nor should it be.
Why haven't you bought into this?
Why should I?
Because you're Jewish, brother. The so-called chosen people. You've been passing for a WASP.
So a Jewish white police officer becomes the person who goes to the Klan. Is that true?
Somewhat. Stallworth does have sort of a white avatar who attends in-person meetings and obviously Klan rituals. But in the book, he's just described as a white man. He's not of Jewish heritage or background. That was kind of a Spike Lee addition.
Right. Because he said, as Ron says, he wants him to have skin in the game. And it actually might have been two white cops, but Stallworth's never identified them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stallworth, because Stallworth didn't retire until 2006, and he wanted to protect not only some aspects of his own identity, but the cops who were possibly still working in the field.
Okay, so this is all true. And by the way, it's also true that Ron Stallworth was sent undercover to see black activist Stokely Carmichael, who changed his name to Kwame Ture, speak at a rally at a local college. In the film, he meets a love interest, a female activist. In fact, she's running this whole event. They're on the line outside, waiting to go in.
You know how we got to Colorado Springs?
Yeah, yeah. The Colorado College Black Student Union invited him.
I can dig it. I can dig it. Are you part of the union?
I'm the president.
Really? I'm talking to the president right now?
Yes, you are.
Right on, sister.
Jasmine Sanders, a couple things to talk about there. You hear Ron Stallworth or David Washington's voice there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that he can speak so fluently with the KKK on the phone is that he's told, and we kind of hear it there, although this is controversial to some people, he has a white voice.
Yes, that's something that's also repeated in the book by Agent Stallworth's sergeant and superiors, which is the idea of a black voice, which kind of does exist, but not in the way that they believe it does, not with regard to like syntax and the way the grammar that one uses when they speak.
Well, and we're going to be doing a separate segment on this, the so-called white voice, black voice. But there's a hilarious moment in the film, and I guess this really happened, where Ron Stallworth on the phone with David Duke, the grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke thinks he's talking to a white man, and he tells him why. What does he say?
David Duke responds that he would be able to detect a black person's voice by their pronunciation of the word R, which he believed black people to have a distinct pronunciation of.
That they say Ara.
Ara, yeah.
Meanwhile, he's talking to a black man on the phone while he says this. So that really happened. But back to this love interest, this female activist, we understand that didn't happen.
Well, the script changed hands from Jordan Peele to Spike Lee. So that was either a Lee or Peele addition. There's no notable love interest mentioned in the book.
Okay. And the costume designer for the film said that the character was inspired by Angela Davis, the activist of the time, and Kathleen Cleaver, the wife of Eldridge Cleaver.
Yes.
More activists. Both of those women were the inspirations for this character's look and attitude. There's also a virulently racist cop in the movie, assaulting people of color. Does he exist in the book?
Not really. There is another cop named Ralph who we know shot an unarmed teenager who we can assume is black, or it's kind of hinted at that the person was of minority, like racial background. But they don't say explicitly. And then he's never punished for that.
And that happened in real life. And in the, in the movie, perhaps embellished on. Again, all of this true. But along the way, David Duke, who is the white supremacist, anti-Semitic, conspiracy theorist, Holocaust denying, former Republican Louisiana state rep. At this time, he's a young man who's forming this modern version of the Klan. He comes to Colorado to meet with this local chapter. That really happened. But is it true that Ron Stallworth is assigned to be David Duke's bodyguard when he comes?
Yes. Yes. Bodyguard, escort throughout Colorado Springs. Yeah. And he snapped that really like funny, chummy photo.
Stallworth goes up to David Duke and says, "Can I take a picture?"
Yes.
And you think to yourself, this black man cannot have just walked up to the Grand Wizard of the KKK and taken a selfie. But he did.
Yeah. The picture is kind of lost to time. Like Stallworth misplaced it in a move, but he claims that it does exist.
Wow. There's another part of the film. Ron Stallworth is, again, guarding David Duke, who's come for this citizenship ceremony where these Klansmen, including the fake white Ron Stallworth, are being sworn into the Klan. Duke and the Klansmen munch on popcorn and watch the racist film Birth of a Nation. That really did happen. At the same time, Spike Lee cuts back and forth to another scene, an elderly civil rights activist telling black college students about a lynching. What's real there?
Duke really does induct the Colorado Springs agent officially into the KKK, which is how Ron Stallworth has his official KKK membership placard. There is not the presence of the sort of elder black activist, which is played by Harry Belafonte in the film. But the incident that the Belafonte character refers to, which is the lynching of Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas, did occur and was potentially a KKK incident, which was inspired by Birth of a Nation.
And you write the pictures the Harry Belafonte character is holding up in that scene of this real lynching. Those are real?
Yes. The pictures of Jesse Washington, a teenager who was convicted of a crime in Waco, Texas, and was lynched and dismembered and had his body burned by a mob, which included some KKK members. The photos were taken and disseminated as postcards and memorabilia of the event. Mm.
Photos by Fred Gildersleeve, you tell us. That was all.
Yes.
That was all real. Oh, boy. There are things apparently Spike Lee did make up. There's a big ending. We won't give it away. But did Ron Stallworth and his white colleagues, did they manage to disrupt this local chapter of the KKK?
Yes, Stallworth writes in his memoir that the focus of the Klan had been at that time several planned firebombings of local gay bars, as well as a few cross burnings. He has a passage which is really poignant and just descriptive about the way that a cross, which is intended to be burned on a lawn, is constructed and the exact dimensions of it and the way that the fuse is lit, which was really one of the most like poignant passages in the book, or shocking, I guess, because it's so hard to get an idea of those things from just reading. But when he lays out the construction of the cross, the dimensions of it, the plans to light it, it's definitely like shocking. So those plans were thwarted, and so that was largely the measure of Ron Stallworth's success.
And the investigation was shut down, even though it was successful. Tell us about that.
There's such a thin line between an infiltration and collusion. So there would have eventually come a time where it's hard to discern, especially as a civilian, are they infiltrating the KKK or are they just acting members of the KKK?
Right. Because, as it turned out, there were people from NORAD who were in the KKK, as they discovered.
There were.
That's Jasmine Sanders. We'll post her article, What's Fact and Fiction in Black Klansmen, from Slate at hereandnow.org. And I really, you know, I don't think it takes away from going to see the movie to know some of these plot twists, because I know I was sitting there thinking, what's true? What's true? So now, if you went, you know. If you're about to go, and we think you should, you'll know. Jasmine, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Uber's revenue growth shows no signs of stopping. In its latest quarterly report out yesterday, the ride-hailing company's revenue rose 63% over the same period last year. Uber is the highest-valued private company in the world. That's the good news for Uber. The bad news is that it's still losing money and it's facing a tough regulatory environment, especially in cities such as New York, which is now limiting the number of Uber vehicles that can be out on the streets. To sort all this out for us is Callum Borchers, senior innovation reporter at WBUR. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Callum.
Hi, Lisa.
So the bottom line sounds like Uber is losing less money. Uber took in $2.8 billion in the second quarter, but overall lost close to $1 billion. It's playing, I guess, by the old adage, you got to spend money to make money. And there is a newish boss at Uber. Is that his strategy?
Yes, that does seem to be the strategy of newish CEO Dara Khosrowshahi. This is what he said in May. He said that we're deliberately investing in the future of our platform. And then he cites investments in things like Uber Eats, the Express Pool, e-bikes and scooters, making investments in the Middle East and India. So essentially, they're losing money on purpose at this point, Lisa. They are just scaling up to get as big as they can, as quickly as they can, with the understanding that they'll be profitable, hopefully, down the line.
So Uber reported that its gross bookings, which are taken to be a measure of demand, rose 41% compared to the same time last year. So lots of customers out there. Seems as if the bad press that came out about Uber over the past year has really not stuck. There was the woman in Arizona who was struck and killed by one of its self-driving cars last March. Some rather boorish behavior by the former CEO. And the fact that six taxicab workers in New York have taken their own lives. They were in direct competition with Uber. Has any of this turned off Uber customers?
Well, it all comes back, I think, to the scale conversation that we were having just a moment ago, right? So you might remember the delete Uber hashtag from last year, and the New York Times reported that about 200,000 users actually did follow through. But remember that Uber says that it has 75 million monthly active users. So even if you get a big boycott of a couple hundred thousand, it's barely a drop in the bucket.
Uber is expected to go public next year. How does the latest quarterly report portend for that IPO?
Well, it shows they're still losing money, as you said, but losing less than they were at this time last year. And also go back to the first quarter of this year when they actually turned a profit by divesting some businesses in Russia and Asia. So what they're doing right now in their recent reports, and keep in mind, they don't have to release these publicly, but what they're doing is signaling to prospective investors that we could be profitable in the future, even though we're not there just yet.
So in the ways, in summary, the ways that Uber is now diversifying, are all of these things, and tell us even beyond things such as Uber Eats, are these happening across the board in other countries as well?
Well, so just last month, Uber joined in with Google and Alphabet to invest $335 million in Lime, which runs those electric scooters people have seen in California. We have some here in Boston, although they're run by another company. Lime also operates those dockless bicycles that have rankled officials in some cities. So what you see here is a strategy to have this, I guess you'd call it, a vertical integration across the entire sharing economy, whether we're talking about bikes, scooters, cars. Uber wants a piece of all of it.
WBUR's Callum Borchers, thank you for speaking with us.
Glad to be with you.
This week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke said that climate change has nothing to do with the increasing frequency and intensity of wildfires in the West. Well, that's not true, according to accepted science, which concludes that this era of megafires is linked to long-term warming and specifically human-caused climate change. How is it that so many argue that? In 1988, Republican presidential nominee George H.W. Bush made a speech about confronting the relatively new phrase to many, climate change. And it turns out it's not really that new at all. Let's get the backstory, the history from our friends at the weekly podcast Backstory. Brian Ballow, you there?
I am. Good to be here.
And Nathan Connolly, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And let's start with you. Climate, you tell us, was a concern even for the earliest settlers in America. People feared that inclement weather was a sign of the powers of evil. There was a famous sermon about that. So tell us a little about that.
Well, sure. I mean, I have to say right up front that concerns about climate and one's behavior are really as old as Noah, right? Mm-hmm. And you can go back to Increase Mather, a very prominent pastor and minister in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who is talking about the voice of God in stormy winds. It's the title of a very famous sermon where he talks about natural processes effectively responding to human behavior, and that if people police their behavior, they'll get God to give them the kind of weather and climate and environment that they need. Now, Mather, of course, recognized that there was a human hand in some of this, and so he was able to think at least about how people's ability to till the land or at least to moderate some of the environments around them might allow for, say, crops to grow more easily. But it was absolutely the case that divine providence had some role to play in the way that human beings should relate to their environment and would.
Well, then you've got Thomas Jefferson, who also was concerned about the climate initially because the Brits were critical of New England climate. And he wanted to make the point that all the activity that was going on here in colonizing was altering the climate, but for good.
Oh, boy, Robin, let's count the ways that the Brits were critical of their American cousins. But yes, Jefferson thought that because America was cultivating, cutting the forests and creating farmland, that this was drawing sea breezes farther inland. And since he assumed this was working to improve the climate of places like Virginia, he said, let's get some more of this. In fact, he even suggested that Spain build a canal through the Panamanian Isthmus. And it wasn't just to send ships through it. He really believed that this would draw sea breezes inland and help the entire North American continent.
Well, but then there really started to be concern about what for many years was called global warming, climate change only recently. And I know you've got something to share on that, Nathan, but I was just looking at this writing in the journal Nature in 1882, and H.A. Phillips writes about the research in hydrogen and marsh gas, and he concludes, from this we may conclude that the increasing pollution of the atmosphere will have a marked influence on the climate of the world. That's in 1882.
Yeah, I mean, the literature on this actually is a half century even before that among the scientific community. I mean, it's going to surprise some listeners to think about the 19th century as a time when people were already writing in some, you know, volume about the effect of human activity on the climate. In 1827, you have French scientists who begin to talk about a so-called hothouse effect. 1896, Swedish scientists get in the mix, and you have a wonderfully titled paper called On the Influence of Carbonic Acid in the Air Upon the Temperature of the Ground, right? And Robin, what's so critical to think about in terms of the age of this reporting and the science is that climate denial is just as old. So if thinking, for instance, about the 1912 moment, you have the Cleveland Plain Dealer in July of 1912 with the great headline, How Smoke Improves the Climate, right? And this is just a quick quote. The more perfect the envelope of carbon dioxide becomes, the more the heat of the sun is kept in the atmosphere and the milder the climate will grow. And it goes on to talk about how the polar north and the polar south will lose much of their terror, unquote, right? So Even if there's an acknowledgement of the science, the effect of that science is still being debated, even in the turn of the 20th century.
Well, on the other hand, in New Zealand, you have a paper published in 1912.
So in August of 1912, there's a New Zealand newspaper that really, the article is brilliant. It's only 61 words. Right. And all it basically says is that we're burning 2 billion tons of coal a year. And with that, we're adding some 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere because of the chemical reactions. And that effect will, again, raise the temperature. Right?
In fact, the effect may be considerable in a few centuries.
In a few centuries. That's right.
And here we are.
That's right. One thing that's important to keep in mind about the moment is that people are much more immediately concerned with man's impact on the weather. So there's an idea that as much as we can talk about the climate in kind of broad terms, how do we make it rain? How do we bring water to certain parts of the country? And so people begin to draw a really important distinction between climate and weather, and frankly are much more concerned about how they can control the weather to meet more immediate ends.
Yeah. Brian Ballow, talk to us about, you know, companies like GE during the Cold War. They began climate manipulation, you know, cloud seeding and stuff, but draw the line from that to climate change.
Well, what GE did was we would call weather manipulation today. They made it snow in the Adirondacks, and all kinds of people wrote into them, you know, wanting snow on demand for Christmas pageants, for movies, that kind of thing. But the same physicists and chemists who were working on this weather manipulation began to realize that with more powerful techniques, they might begin to reshape climate and this same kind of science that led to potential snow for Christmas pageants was soon being developed and weaponized to actually change the climate over some of our enemies, specifically the Soviet Union.
I mean, it's amazing to think about the moment of being, you know, aware of climate and all the different ways you can use it, because really the 60s and 70s become a period of broad consensus about humans' impact on the environment. President Johnson writes a very important report on restoring the quality of our environment, Earth Day in 1970, to the point where even oil companies like Exxon really do have to get into the act. You have Exxon scientists who are working on trying to figure out how to, you know, deal with the problem of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
But right? They also hid their concerns about climate change.
Well, in part. I mean, part of it relied, frankly, on what the regulatory environment was. So by the time you reached the Reagan era, there wasn't the same kind of morale in the White House around dealing with the climate that they found during the Carter administration. And then ultimately, it turned into a kind of internal conversation among Exxon and executives where they were aware of the climate science but didn't really want too much of it to go public. In fact, what in fact happened was in 1989, Exxon basically joins a lobbying company and begins to now start sowing the seeds of climate denial.
Yeah. Well, let's leapfrog a little bit. You've got, as we said, George H.W. Bush and his opponent, Michael Dukakis, both competing to see who could be more concerned about climate change.
Yeah, that tank that Dukakis drove around and left quite a carbon footprint.
Right. And in that same year, you've got NASA scientist James Hansen, who went before the Senate Energy Committee, said, you know, time to stop waffling on this issue. But what happened? Some in the press, you know, we debate in the media, were we too slow to say you don't have to have an opponent of the notion of climate change or global warming on every time you talk about it? There's that conversation going on about were we too slow to just say this is accepted science? What happened? How are we still divided on whether or not it's even true, as it's pretty much understood we're in it.
Well, I hate to simplify it all and call it interest group politics, but there are a lot of financial interests, and frankly, there are a lot of jobs that are very connected to the fossil fuel economy. And we shouldn't be surprised that those people who are engaged in that line of work are going to defend that way of life pretty vigorously. And, you know, frankly, we all enjoy the benefits of being able to drive as much as we want and not pay the full costs of carbon fuel.
I keep going back to that 1912 New Zealand article titled Coal Consumption Affecting Climate and the Furnaces of the World Burning Tons of Coal, Adding Tons of Carbon Dioxide to the Atmosphere. This tends to make the air a more effective blanket for the Earth and to raise its temperature. The effect may be considerable in a few centuries.
I love that line because it brings one point home, which is, you know, our time is not the world's time. And regardless of whatever debate we have, Mother Nature is going to get the last word.
Yeah. And you have the last word in this segment. That's Nathan Connolly, along with Brian Ballow, historians, co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory, with the backstory of climate change, global warming. Brian, Nathan, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
We're remembering the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. She died earlier today at the age of 76 at her home in the Detroit area. She had advanced pancreatic cancer. Stevie Wonder and Jesse Jackson were among those who paid their final respects to her earlier this week. President Trump tweeted about Franklin, "She was a great woman with a wonderful gift from God, her voice." Former President Obama and Michelle Obama released a statement. In part, it read, "In her voice, we could feel our history, all of it, and in every shade." We're joined now by NPR's Eric Deggans. Eric, you were a music critic before you were a TV critic, and you were also a musician in a band that was signed by Motown Records. Who knew?
Yeah.
Eric, Aretha Franklin began singing solos in the church where her father preached, and gospel was in her blood. Let's hear first some of Mary, Don't You Weep. She's singing with the Southern California Community Choir. What can you tell us, Eric, about her voice and her ability to sing so many genres with such ease?
Well, you know, I feel like she's arguably the best singer in American pop music history. Mm. She developed this amazing talent, this voice, and also piano playing in the gospel tradition and R&B and soul tradition, but she crossed so many boundaries with it and became a classic artist who also scored hits in rock and pop and even did work in classical music. She cemented the idea of the modern R&B diva with her great stage costumes and her sweeping hairdos and her regal manner and her incredible talent for singing and knowing just how to wring the most emotion out of a song and bring those gospel flavors into whatever she was singing. She transcended this idea that gospel singers couldn't sing secular music or that R&B and soul singers couldn't have pop hits. And she supported the civil rights movement when it needed her most. And she also resurrected her own career in many important times, doing some of her best work for Atlantic Records after Columbia Records couldn't really provide a great home for her. And then moving on to Arista Records and to have hits in the 1980s. She was just an amazing artist.
And you mentioned how she illuminated the works of so many songwriters, among them, of course, Carole King and Jerry Goffin. Here's Aretha performing A Natural Woman. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, and you're the key to my peace of mind. 'Cause you make me feel, you make me feel.
Eric Deggans, we remember the Kennedy Center Honors. There's Carole King in the balcony freaking out at Aretha
right.
Franklin
as
singing.
As one would.
As one would. But you know, I just want to ask, she was royalty. She, the way she presented herself, and we're seeing all these pictures today of her as a young woman, completely humble. But just could you just put your finger on what she became, you know, what she was to us, approachable but not. She was separate. Yeah.
Well, she was authentic, is what I would say. She was always Aretha, no matter where she appeared. And what was interesting about her is that she could take a song like "Natural Woman" that was written by somebody else, or "Respect," and make it her own. And, you know, so Otis Redding had to acknowledge that even though he recorded Respect first, she's the one who made it into a classic. And Carole King, of course, has always tipped her hat to Aretha as the woman who made that song, legendary. And beyond that, she also co-wrote some really signature hits like Think and Rocksteady. And she co-wrote Who's Zooming Who even in the 1980s. So this is a woman who, had brought talents to bear in all sorts of ways, from being a great pianist to a co-songwriter and songwriter and a vocalist, and also pioneering in the worlds of civil rights and in the music business and guiding her own career.
And here's Eric Deggans. You mentioned that she also sang classical. We have a piece of music that we'd actually like to linger over a little bit. So just we're going to do that in the time that we have. This is Puccini's Nessun Dorma. She had to step in for Pavarotti, who was taken ill mm-hmm. and couldn't perform. She stepped in and did this.
Doing the Grammys.
Listeners are reminding us that, you know, it's a standard song for aspiring opera singers to prove their skill, to see how they do it. She took it apart and put it back together. So we're going to listen a little. Eric Deggans, thank you.
Thank you.
D'amore e di spero.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.